Welcome and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Gary Scanlon, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in the same group. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, Gary.
In this episode of the podcast, we return once again to one of our favorite topics, the OECD's two-pillar solution. Today, we have spilled a lot of pot ink on pillar two. Today, though, we'll focus our attention on a slightly less ambitious, but no less important component, pillar one's amount B, which for some countries may come into effect as early as next year. In this episode, we'll explain what Amount B is, discuss its potential impact, and explore the various issues with Amount B that countries are still struggling to resolve at the OECD. For our discussion today, we're joined by Jesse Coleman, a principal in the WNT Transfer Pricing Group, and Thomas Becky, a senior manager in the same group. Jesse and Thomas, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Gary. Delighted to be here.
Thanks, Gary.
So before we dive into Amount B, Jesse, can you explain the problem that Amount B is trying to solve and why it's considered part of Pillar 1 alongside Amount A? They seem to be a strange pair.
Absolutely. And I completely agree with you. They do seem a strange pair. So we've got Amount A, which is essentially a new taxing rate that I know that you and Gary have talked about a lot. And here we have Amount B. So that's really surrounding routine distribution functions. And one thing that we know as transfer pricing practitioners, which might be new to you and Gary, is
there's a surprising amount of controversy surrounding transfer pricing and distribution. Meaning, for example, if a company in country D purchases products from its related party in country M, and country D performs sales and distribution functions, there's a lot of conflict surrounding what price should company D pay to its related party in country M, and what is the overall profits company D should earn.
This is difficult for taxpayers. It's also really difficult for tax administrations. And when I say tax administrations, it's difficult for both countries in the US, so developed countries, but this is a real sticking point for developing countries that just don't have the resources in place to look at transfer pricing issues. That's a big driver here. So really, you can think of Amount B as being a carrot for developing countries, as well as for businesses in the Pillar 1 solution. Going back to the difference between Amount B and Amount A is the reallocation of taxing rates. Amount B, on the other hand, at least tries to be an approximation of the existing transfer pricing rules. So I think it's really fair to say that Amount B does not logically flow from Amount A. It's really a political connection only.
Thanks, Jesse. So is it fair to say then, just as Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 are now on two different paths, that Amount A and Amount B are also now on two different paths?
It's a very interesting question, Kristen. At a certain point, that was true. The paths diverged for Amounts A and B. And now Amount B itself is actually rather confusingly on two different paths, with one of those paths aligning with Amount A. So we currently have a finalized version of Amount B that came out in February and is now part of the OECD transfer pricing guidelines. So that's final. Countries can adopt it or ignore it as they choose. Separately, you have ongoing work on a slightly different version of Amount B that would be mandatory for countries that adopt the Amount A MLC or multilateral convention, if and when that comes to fruition. And we don't know exactly what that version of Amount B would look like. It's something that's been very difficult in negotiations, we understand.
So we'll delve more into the politics of Amount B later, but first let's explore some of the more important aspects of Amount B, specifically which taxpayers are impacted, how is Amount B calculated, and whether it even achieves its intended purpose. First things first, Thomas, who's affected by Amount B?
So Amount B on the taxpayer side is primarily aimed at buy-sell distribution, but they've expanded the scope to also cover sales agent arrangements and commissioner arrangements within the same context. And within that buy-sell or agency context, what you're looking at is wholesale distribution of tangible goods. So non-tangible goods are out of scope, services are out of scope, commodities are also separately scoped out. Retail sales that are not de minimis are scoped out. It's really trying to get at that wholesale distribution. And then it has to be baseline, which is a separate determination.
So if I'm a tangible goods distributor in an Amount B implementing country, would I be in scope for Amount B?
It's a great question, Gary. And unfortunately, the answer is it depends. And some of this gets back to what Thomas said about this baseline, which is a bit of a new concept. So if you look at the February document that the OECD published, there's a quantitative component. So you can be in as long as you meet a quantitative threshold. And that's based on a tested party's ratio of operating expenses to sales, which you can think of as a proxy for like functional intensity. There's also a qualitative component to whether you are in scope. So you're trying to answer here with this qualitative component a very tricky transfer pricing question. So essentially, qualitatively, unless a one-sided method is appropriate, you would not be in scope. So you essentially need to prove that a one-sided method is appropriate.
So for non-transfer pricing folks, let me explain what that means. Going back to my example of company D that is buying products from its related party that's in country M. So one side to look at this in order to figure out the right transfer pricing is to only look at company D and look at its profitability. We can't do that for transfer pricing purposes if, for example, company D and company M are both bringing intangibles to the table. So maybe they're both jointly developing the product that company D is selling. In that case, we would need to look at both company D as well as its counterparty, so the party in country M, and perhaps think of a two-sided method like a profit split.
So that sounds simple, but to be honest with you, this folds into so many tricky transfer pricing questions like economic ownership of intangibles and control of risk. So really the arguments that we are hearing from taxing authorities that generally support more profit should be left in their jurisdiction because of these factors.
So doesn't this type of qualitative scoping mechanism take away from the stated purpose and intent of Amount B to reduce transfer pricing disputes? I mean, wouldn't this just create more disputes around whether or not you're in scope in the first place?
It's a great question. I'd say that Amount B is going to reduce, but it's not going to eliminate the potential for disputes in this area, and largely because the point that you noted. So countries are going to look at that qualitative scoping, and they would have the ability to filter out companies that they say are assuming critical risk or creating intangibles.
So once you've concluded that a taxpayer is in scope, is the road clear at that point? I mean, Thomas, is it as easy as just determining your transfer pricing for such activities based on X percent return on sales?
In theory, it should be that easy. In practice, what we are finding out is that it can actually be quite challenging. So setting aside a little bit of the nuance that I think we don't need to get into here and the corroborative mechanism and the different data uplift mechanisms, what you really are dealing with in Amount B for pricing is a matrix that will prescribe a certain range of return on sales results for the company, for the tested party, based on the industry in which it's distributing, its ratio of operating expenses to sales, which is again a sort of proxy for functional intensity, and its ratio of operating assets to sales, so its asset intensity. And what we find is that these things are actually quite tricky in some cases to calculate. There's a lot of judgment involved from an accounting perspective and what goes into these different categories. Some companies are finding that they have much higher operating asset intensity than they would have expected and questioning whether that really makes sense or whether it's sort of an accounting quirk. The pricing can get more complicated than that if you are dealing with an entity that performs another function besides distribution, or potentially one that is performing distribution for multiple related parties, because the way that the amount B guidance is framed, it applies to distribution transactions, and where you have multiple transactions with related parties being carried out by a single distribution entity, it seems that it might be necessary to apply amount B on a segmented basis, which brings with it all of its own challenges.
I understand that countries have a fair amount of leeway in whether and to what extent they implement amount B. Thomas, can you explain what this optionality is and how does that impact taxpayers?
Absolutely. And one of the biggest items, Gary, I think, is that the guidance that has been issued on amount B does not specify whether a jurisdiction should adopt amount B as a prescribed return, essentially as an across-the-board simplification, saying that this pricing matrix and the other mechanisms that go along with it is the final answer on what an arm's length return for baseline marketing and distribution is, or whether that country should instead adopt amount B on a safe harbor basis, allowing a taxpayer that thinks it qualifies and can meet the criteria to apply it, but not forcing taxpayers to do so. So that decision is apparently going to be made on a country-by-country basis, and how countries make that decision is, I think, very much going to inform how companies, how taxpayers react. Another thing in this area that is important to note is that you do have a political commitment within the amount B framework to respect the application of amount B if the jurisdiction applying it is what's called a covered jurisdiction. And initially, covered jurisdiction was supposed to really refer primarily to low capacity jurisdictions, jurisdictions that don't have the ability on their own to really do a traditional transfer pricing analysis that need to rely on simplified measures like amount B. That concept has expanded somewhat. That's why they've changed the term from low capacity jurisdiction to covered jurisdiction. But that's still at the heart of it. You still have this commitment in some cases for a counterparty jurisdiction to respect the application of amount B. But in most cases, in cases where you're dealing, for example, with two large developed countries, you're generally not going to have a commitment to respect amount B on the other side. And so you're going to be in this odd situation where amount B applies to one side of the transaction and not to the other. And what that means for taxpayers is that the compliance exercise really doesn't get any easier. And in fact, it may actually get more complicated, because instead of having a new streamlined amount B documentation package, you're still doing your existing documentation exercise on one side of the transaction. And on the other side, you're then adding in the amount B component. You're not taking anything away.
That's really interesting, Thomas. Thank you. Jesse, are we expecting future guidance? And if so, what are some of the issues that our clients are looking for more clarity on?
Well, the first thing is knowing which countries are going to decide to implement this and how they are going to implement it. So number one, just knowing when it applies, which there's a bit of an imperative given that the document gives countries the ability to start applying it as of January 1st, 2025. There's also guidance that we're also waiting for. If we go back to what we have gotten, is that we've gotten a February document that officially updated the OECD guidelines. We got a little bit more in June, but there's a lot more that we need. So we have, I think, maybe about 50 pages in total, and there's a lot of questions that just haven't been answered yet. So what we're expecting on our side is some administrative guidance or something that might be closer to an FAQ. So guidance that kind of fills in the gaps, I would say, of the February and June documents. And one thing we've been doing as we've been working with companies to see how it applies is we've been identifying what those gaps are and trying to make sure that that would be identified as something that would be discussed in the administrative guidance.
Thanks, Jesse. So this finalized version of amount B that we've been talking about, when does it become effective?
That's a great question. So the February report says that amount B can become effective as of January 1st, 2025, but it also puts it in the OECD transfer pricing guidelines. So I would say that it's already in the guidelines. So it's going to really depend on what countries decide to implement and when they decide to implement. So not a clear answer here.
So as far as countries that either have implemented or intend to implement, do we have any takers on this?
I think we do, Kristen. We don't have anything that we've yet seen published that is final and official from a given jurisdiction. But the OECD in the last round of guidance that they put out on Amount B in June noted that there have been expressions of interest to apply this version of Amount B by Argentina, Brazil, Costa Rica, Mexico, and South Africa. We also know that the U.S. has been a very big supporter of Amount B throughout the process. They're continuing to negotiate for that mandatory version of Amount B that I mentioned earlier, but I expect that they would also very likely do something with the current version of Amount B, even if you never see a mandatory Amount B come into practice. You've also heard expressions of interest and support from ATAF, the African Tax Administration Forum. Other countries have been less supportive. India, in the February guidance, had quite a few reservations on this version of Amount B. We understand there may be reservations also with respect to the mandatory version that is under negotiation. Australia and New Zealand have both made comments publicly suggesting that they likely would not adopt this version of Amount B. They recognize that they have an existing framework in place for dealing with baseline marketing and distribution, and they think that works perfectly well without needing to go to this framework. So it's definitely still evolving. The jurisdictions that have expressed commitment have not, at least publicly, said when that's going to happen. So it could be next year, it could be a little more delayed. We'll be monitoring that space and watching for when you have the first taker.
So you mentioned that the U.S. is a big supporter of Amount B. Why is the U.S. such a big supporter? And then how would the U.S. implement Amount B? As we've discussed before on this podcast, Amount A is unlikely to be adopted by the U.S., given that it requires congressional action, and in particular, ratification of a treaty. Is Amount B similar?
So the U.S. has been very supportive of Amount B, including the mandatory version, because they really believe in its ability to reduce controversy with respect to really routine distribution transactions that you would not think would generate a lot of dispute, but have been generating really substantial volumes of disputes that take significant resources from the U.S. competent authority in particular to resolve, when they could be focused on so many other things that are more challenging and more deserving, frankly, of their time. So this is an area that really, I think, from the IRS perspective, is ripe for simplification. So we mentioned earlier that Amount B came about as part of the overall Pillar One project with Amount A. It seems quite likely now that Congress is going to struggle to adopt Amount A. Amount B has quite different prospects in the U.S. Amount B may not need congressional action at all, depending on whether the U.S. implements it as a safe harbor or as a prescriptive measure. There's a lot to think about there in terms of how consistent Amount B is exactly with the arm's length principle, with Section 42 overall. But certainly it seems like something that Treasury or IRS could, through regulations or a notice, put out as a safe harbor without needing any change to the statutory scheme.
I mean, just one thing to point out, though, is there is a matrix that puts forth return on sales based on a couple of industry and then operating expenses to sales and assets to sales. I think we would be remiss if we didn't say that we could see taxing authorities, the U.S., as well as every taxing authority around the world, looking to this reference point, regardless of what happens going forward.
That's absolutely right, Jesse. And indeed, we've started to see that already in some cases where competent authorities are expressly asking about how the Amount B framework would apply in a case, even though there has been no formal adoption of Amount B on either side.
Jesse, what are the more controversial aspects from the perspective of implementing jurisdictions? So, for example, what are India's reservations on Amount B?
India's got a lot of reservations, probably too many to handle on this podcast here. But why don't we take this high level and just talk about two big issues that I see that are across a lot of the countries in the inclusive framework. So number one is I think there needs to be more on the qualitative scoping criteria piece, meaning I'm a bit concerned. I think, Gary, you had pointed this out, that won't governments, if a country implements Amount B, wouldn't the government just say, well, you, company X, really qualitatively, you don't qualify for Amount B. And essentially, there'll be controversy around the scoping. So one thing that we were hoping that the OECD would come out with more details surrounding when an entity would be in scope on a qualitative side of Amount B. I think from a non-technical point as well, we of course see a lot of countries that just don't think the Amount B returns are sufficient. Or for example, they'll make the argument that their market is just too unique to use the same comparable set, so the same Amount B set that all the other countries should use.
Jesse, I think that those are both really interesting points. And I think that to some extent, they may be linked in practice where you can easily imagine a case where you have a local tax auditor who does not think that the Amount B return is sufficient for what the local distributor is doing and finds that one way to address that is to argue on the qualitative scoping basis. I think that having an additional qualitative scoping criterion is really sort of an exit hatch for tax authorities that don't want to apply Amount B in all circumstances. It gives another lever to pull to take a taxpayer out of scope of Amount B back into the normal transfer pricing regime and back into the normal audit regime.
Thanks, Thomas, and thanks, Jesse. Where does Amount B go from here?
So I think number one, we are going to see jurisdictions pick up Amount B and adopt Amount B. How that happens and when that happens, I'm not quite sure, but I think that will be happening soon. I think we also have some countries that, and I kind of mentioned this before, they won't formally adopt it, but they're going to apply it on what I'd say maybe an ad hoc basis. So this gets back to the point that we have a set of numbers that put out a point for a routine distribution function. And I think it's going to be hard for taxing authorities not to look to those numbers when they look to benchmark functions that are similar.
I think there's another more positive ad hoc possibility. And to understand this, I think it helps to consider the way that the U.S. competent authority works and the way that competent authority negotiations to resolve double tax cases work. Because we in the U.S. have a very detailed set of regulations under Section 42. Other countries have their own rules, their own regulations for transfer pricing. There is broad similarity, but if each competent authority were to stick entirely to its own regulations, you would have quite a few cases that could not be resolved successfully in the mutual agreement procedure or MAP. And so what they do in practice is the U.S. competent authority negotiates on the basis of the OECD guidelines so that it and its counterparties can have a single set of guidance that gives them a common basis for resolving cases. And we understand that the U.S. competent authority has really been pushing to make Amount B part of that common basis for analyzing and resolving double tax cases involving transfer pricing. So it's entirely possible that even in a world where the U.S. never formally adopts Amount B or the counterparty jurisdiction never formally adopts Amount B, you could have agreement at the competent authority level that they, for cases that come into their jurisdiction, are going to apply Amount B in their bilateral negotiations. And I think that could be a very powerful tool for easing the burdens on MAP inventories and making dispute resolution more speedy.
So it looks like the only certainty ahead is a future in which Amount B exists in some form. Jesse, how do you think our clients should be preparing for this future?
I think first and most importantly is to figure out what Amount B means for you. For some clients, this won't mean anything. But for those who are distributing tangible goods, I would say they should really look at Amount B and look, number one, at the scoping to see if there would be an argument that they would be in scope. And then I think, secondly, if the answer is either a maybe or a yes, absolutely, we would be in scope, look at it from a quantitative side. So do the modeling to see what the Amount B return would look like across different jurisdictions. And we've been doing this with some companies, and there are actually a lot of surprises out there, specifically with the operating asset intensity. So the balance sheet side of these transactions that may not have been looked at in quite some time from a transfer pricing perspective. So looking at what the operating assets are for the distribution function and seeing, first of all, if there's any questions that come up about what those are, but seeing what that means in terms of the matrix that was published in February. One thing that we are finding is that companies are really surprised when they look at their operating assets that they've got large balances that they just didn't know were there. So I'd say once they get that down, what would the Amount B return be? I think companies should weigh in and look if that number makes sense. Also look at your operations, look at your policies, and if it doesn't make sense, see if there's a way to change those policies and make it make sense.
Thank you, Jesse and Thomas, for joining us today to discuss Amount B, and a special thanks to Samira Varanasi for her help with this episode. We'll be looking out for future administrative guidance on Amount B, but with Amount B potentially around the corner for some taxpayers, we hope this episode has given listeners, especially in transfer pricing groups, some food for thought as they review their transfer pricing policies for marketing and distribution activities. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.